Today's show is sponsored in part by StrongDM. Automate access control and auditing across your entire infrastructure with features including activity and session logs, session replay, and more. Go to strongdm.com/packetpushers to start your free trial today.
Hey, everybody. Today's episode of Day 2 Cloud is sponsored by Datadog, and you've probably heard them. They're a pretty popular monitoring platform for cloud-scale infrastructure and applications. If you'd like to know more, you can visit datadog.com/day2cloud and get your free Datadog t-shirt. That's datadog.com/day2cloud. Welcome to Day 2 Cloud. Today we are talking about two conferences that Ethan and I took some time out of our busy schedule to attend. And these aren't in-person conferences, dear listener. No, these are virtual conferences. And Ethan and I might have some feelings about virtual conferences in general. So I think we are first going to start with a discussion of virtual conferences in general, of which we've both attended a few. And then we're going to dive into the details, starting with Ansible Fest and then getting into HashiConf Digital. So welcome, Ethan. How you doing, buddy?
Dude, I have moved house and many of things I own are still in boxes somewhere. There's a big pile of boxes down in the basement we call Mount Doom. And, you know, sometimes we have to go hunting in Mount Doom to find the thing, whatever the thing is. But aside from that, fine. Most of the stress is behind. It's been a couple of weeks, so we're starting to settle in, and that's good. But the virtual conference thing, man, let's talk about that for a minute. Because there's been a lot of them. That is my first feeling. And I feel that there have been very many virtual conferences, and I don't know that I want to take – I don't know that I want to go to anymore, man. It's been a lot.
It has. And I think part of it is when you attend a physical conference, you're physically there. So you can't just – meander off and go make a sandwich in the kitchen while a conference talk is going on because you're not anywhere near your kitchen. But when you're at a virtual conference, you have all the distractions of home and possibly work on top of it.
Well, and possibly work. And that's actually what's happened to me. So you said in the intro, like, oh, we've taken the time to attend this and that. And I'm like, okay, in reality for me, Ansible Fest, I registered for it. That's how as far as I got, because there were so many other things that ate up my time. People don't, when you're not in the office or when you're not out of the office because you're at home doing your normal thing, people don't respect that, hey, I'm supposed to be going to this a virtual event and attending. And therefore, I got scheduled for a bunch of stuff because that's life. I just got scheduled for a bunch of stuff. So it ended up being, if I have time, I'll hit this session. I'll hit this session. Maybe I'll watch a keynote. And instead, it's been, I'm using my Ansible Fest login. I'm looking at the content archive, of which there is a ton of stuff, and picking and choosing sessions that I want to watch. I reviewed some announcements. And I don't know, maybe you've had some better luck, man. I just, I struck out with Ansible Fest as it turned out.
Well, when I think about how I attended conferences in the past, in-person conferences, the primary way I would attend them was by not attending sessions. I think, you know, and in any given day during a conference, I would attend the keynotes and maybe one other session. But I spent the bulk of my time, and I think this is true of you as well, Ethan, I spent the bulk of my time out in the expo hall talking to people, stopping by vendor booths and checking out their stuff, you know, setting up dinner plans for later that day. That was a conference to me. The sessions were all going to be recorded anyway. So why would I spend time with those?
Yeah, it was a mix. I did an awful lot of exactly what you said, Ned, out in the expo hall, looking at different vendors showing off their wares, striking up interesting conversation with folks, trying to understand their technology, but especially startups. Oh, I love startups and new ideas and what they're doing and problems that they're solving and stuff, having those conversations. And yeah, planning some kind of a meetup for later in the day where you're going to get to know some folks and just either just relax and enjoy yourself or be able to have kind of an offline chat and learn something that, that maybe you wouldn't be able to otherwise find out. And the virtual conferences, it's like a really long webinar instead.
That's true. And I think at least the conferences that I've attended have not done a great job of grabbing and keeping my attention because it very much feels like a webinar. And a lot of the sessions are pre-recorded, so you don't even get the spontaneity of live presentations. It's, obviously someone reading a script and the video has been edited. So why am I watching this quote unquote live? I'm not really sure.
I don't know. It could be just that we're very fatigued with all of it. And because there's been so many of them this year, it's just been the go-to. But I want the event organizers to maybe reboot the formats a bit and come up with some other things. But at the same time, myself being a person who's organized some of these virtual events, I don't have all the answers for this either. I don't know how you reorganize it, because there's nothing like the in-person kind of meetings that you have. We call it the hallway track, and you're getting together at a restaurant or something afterwards and having those discussions. There's nothing in the virtual world that really replaces that. And I think that's something, it just is what it is. I don't know that there's a way to fix that.
True. Well, now that we've talked enough about what we don't like about virtual conferences, let's talk about the two virtual conferences that you and I ostensibly attended.
Ostensibly, yes, ostensibly attended. So let's start with Ansible Fest. This one was on my plate. Ansible, of course, huge in the automation world, lots and lots of folks using it. And of course, my background in networking, a lot of people in the networking world have gravitated towards Ansible. Well, lovely. What all came out of Ansible Fest? So let me talk about the event itself, first of all. As I said, I didn't actually attend anything that was live, but I was fully registered, and I've gone through the content archives a bit to see what they've done. And if you're looking for the very latest in Ansible content, it's very well organized. It's easy to find. They highlight the keynotes, as you would expect, and there are a few things in the keynote section kind of stuck out to me. It's relating to the future of the Red Hat Ansible Automation Platform, which is their formal name for, I think, the commercial flavor that they have of Ansible. It was a little fuzzy to me which is the open source Ansible, which is the Red Hat commercial Ansible that you're going to spend money on and so on. But that's what the Red Hat Ansible Automation Platform, that's the highfalutin name for it. There's some future keynotes that they had there in a panel discussion that was interesting if you want to know where Red Hat's mind is on these things. Other than that, keynotes are keynotes. It was hard to get too excited about them because, you know, yeah, you go to the keynotes because you kind of want to know what's on the mind of the leaders at that particular organization's event and hear from them what they're talking about. But a lot of times those keynotes are pretty... I don't know, man. How many keynotes have you been to, Ned, where you were like, oh, that was so amazing. I'm so glad I heard that.
It's like 1 out of 20 is actually like, because a lot of it depends on the speakers themselves just being dynamic. And a lot of the time the founder of the company or higher up wants to be the one to do the presentation. And they may not have the best presentation skills for large audiences. That is something yes. that you really do have to work and practice at. And some people are very good at it. So there's that aspect. There's also the aspect of making what is relatively dry news interesting. And you do also sometimes have to bring in all of your customers and brag about them. And that can be done very well. And it can also be done very poorly. And it's usually the latter.
It all depends on the customer, yeah, but they're marquee, impressive. Look who we brought to the platform. It's so-and-so from blah, blah company. Hey, and then it's like, okay, you're just talking about how you use the product. Okay.
Hey, everybody. We're taking a quick break for a message from our sponsor, StrongDM. StrongDM automates access to and audits of your entire infrastructure. That includes servers, databases, and Kubernetes clusters, no matter where your employees are. Trusted by companies like Hearst, Peloton, and SoFi to manage access, you'll have more control and less hassle. With StrongDM, you can automate onboarding and offboarding and move people within roles with the click of a button. StrongDM gives you features including activity logs, session replay, one-click remote access, and onboarding and offboarding employees, contracts, and vendors with a single click. StrongDM, automate access control and auditing across your entire infrastructure. And you can start your free trial today by going to strongdm.com/packetpushers. That's strongdm.com/packetpushers. And we thank StrongDM for being a sponsor. And now, back to the conversation.
Back to Ansible Fest Content Archive. I mean, if you register, and I believe you can still register, even if you weren't registered for the live event, you could still register now and get access to the Content Archive. It is very well organized, broken up into channels. leadership, or maybe you're in architecture, or you're a dev, or you're an ops, et cetera. Well, they've got 6 different channels, and you can drill in via that channel organization what you want to get at. And they also highlight, is it a culture session or a breakout session? Culture being more the human elements of dealing with automation and the world of automation and bringing your IT organization around. And we've had some really good podcasts around that, Ned. The breakout sessions seem to be more deeply nerdy and technical with demos and so on. And they were all, I actually dropped in on several of the breakout ones, and they were all people pretty much at home doing a screen share, showing you how to do the thing, whatever the thing was with Ansible that you wanted to see. It could be a new collection they were showing off or whatever, some technique. Lots and lots and lots of content in there. Many, many, many hours that you could find there in the Ansible Fest content archive. And it cost me nothing. It was free. So,
right.
Yeah. Okay. That was good. Isn't that the other joke about virtual events? It's all free. So is it valuable if it's
free? You get what you pay for?
Well, there's some of that, right? Because what is Ansible Fest ultimately? It's a gigantic marketing campaign for Red Hat, really. They're trying to build community and knowledge around this product so that people use the thing so that they ultimately make money on this intellectual property asset they acquired however many years back that it was. So I'm not criticizing Red Hat here. That's all the virtual events. That's what they are. At the core of them, that is what they are.
Right. And not to go off on too much of a tangent, but I think the thing that would be more valuable and what I see a lot of organizations starting to do is doing smaller, shorter, focused sessions on specific products and features that don't require as much of a commitment of people's time. Like maybe just an open house or open office hours once a week around this product. And those seem to be slightly more successful than a big whiz-bang virtual conference.
Yeah, the big whiz-bang virtual conference does demand too much of people's time because I certainly felt that with my schedule being double booked, making it very difficult to attend the live event, and I'm just picking and choosing what I can afterwards. And the open office hours thing, things like that, it does kind of, depending on the delivery model, is it just another webinar? Is that what virtual events are now just webinars? I don't know. It's hard to distinguish sometimes.
The few that I've attended have been like a live Zoom call, basically, yep, where people can drop in and literally just ask questions. They don't have that much of an agenda, and it's all very community driven. And that to me is more interesting because it's people coming up with real problems or real things that they want to see or do in the platform and getting advice from the people that are literally writing the code for that thing.
I like the sound of that. That really does appeal to me quite strongly. I was listening to it was either Python Bytes or Talk Python to Me podcast, and they were describing an event where the whole thing was to live stream taking a particular Python app and converting it from Django to Flask or something. I don't remember exactly what the context was, but it was 3 hours of him without a script, not exactly knowing how to do what he was doing, going through it and everyone making comments along the way as he worked on that project. And at the end of it, he had completed the thing that he had completed, and everyone along the way was able to participate. That feels like a way more interesting kind of a virtual event than slide whipping the poor audience for hours at a time until they just beg you to stop. So,
oh, that might be the image of the day, slide whipping. That's so... so on point. But let's try to get it back on the rails and talk a little bit about Ansible Fest. So there were obviously some announcements that came out of it. What were the things that caught your eye or grabbed your attention about what's going on in the world of Ansible?
3 big ones. The first was the integration of Red Hat Ansible Automation Platform and Red Hat Advanced Cluster Management for Kubernetes. In other words, they're making it so that you can use Red Hat's Ansible and Red Hat's OpenShift as a unified tool chain that looks and feels like they belong together is how I interpreted this announcement. This was the announcement I think Red Hat led with. So if you're in the Red Hat ecosystem, if you're a consumer of Kubernetes via their iteration of it with being OpenShift, and you're trying to introduce more automation to that world, okay, they've updated Ansible. I think what Red Hat has done is updated their specific flavor of Ansible Automation Platform, so that it can better communicate with and act upon Kubernetes clusters. And again, it wants to feel like it's all one set of tools is the big idea. So I'll read a quote from an announcement here, Ned, and see what you make of this. So when application level or traditional IT workflows are needed, it acts as a control plane across Red Hat OpenShift clusters to trigger Ansible automation platform capabilities, such as deploying system updates and configuring load balancers and scaling server resources and more. In other words, all the kind of stuff you'd be doing with Ansible if you were acting on a server environment, only now you're doing it in a Kubernetes environment.
Interesting. Are they using some sort of operator for that, that's looking for a custom resource to be created, and then that's triggering a workflow in Ansible? Or did you not get into that level of detail?
It didn't get quite that granular in the press release, because the press release is, you got to read it like four times just to find what the heck it is they're actually trying to say in and amongst all the buzzwords, which was pretty frustrating. But They didn't give you the mechanics in that release that I'm referring to about how they're doing it, but they did emphasize single workflow, the result of all of this combination of the Ansible and advanced cluster management is a single workflow to manage wherever your OpenShift or Kate's stuff is, in the cloud, in your local cloud, wherever it might be. You can now automate a lot of the changes that you might want to make in a Kubernetes cluster. Although, as classic for a lot of these kind of announcements that they make at the fests and the cons, this integration is slated for technology preview in the coming weeks.
Okay.
So at some point we'll see this as a real thing.
Right.
So that was the big announcement, or the leading announcement, and the rest of them were, we will talk quickly through the rest of them here. They're pretty minor and we can cover them quick. New content collections. This is another one of those, you know, new Ansible content collections where I'm reading the press release going, what are they trying to say? It's and finally I got down to it. Oh, they've just released new content collections for OpenShift, one for Kubernetes Core, and then a third one for VMware vSphere's REST API. Huh. So I don't know if you have you gotten into Ansible collections at all, Ned?
I have not, so you need to explain that a little bit to me.
These were new to me as well. They were announced just about a year ago. We're recording this in November 2019, and they were announced, I think, in November 2020, and they were announced in November or December 2019. So an Ansible content collection can be described as a package format for Ansible content, one of their blogs says. The format is a simple, predictable data structure with a straightforward definition, and then they take you through things like docs and playbooks and plugins and roles and tests and so on. You bundle all that together into a package, and now your Ansible installation can deal with this particular kind of a device. And so I looked at the official list of Ansible collections, and there's, I believe, 60 providers right now that are considered officially supported Ansible collections. And for the networking nerds that are listening to this show, the list was pretty extensive of networking providers: Arista, Aruba, A10, Checkpoint, Cisco F5, FRR, Fortinet, Juniper, Splunk, and more. Networking providers were in there. I didn't take you through the whole list, but
we'll include the link in the show notes if anybody wants to check out what that full list is. But it seems like it's pretty extensive.
It is, and it feels like a good way to add the knowledge and capability to your Ansible installation easily. You just use a collection. Now, so related to this, Ned, is the third and final announcement that we'll cover from Ansible Fest 2020, which is around the automation hub. So what is an automation hub? Well, where do you collect your collections? In an automation hub. That's what that is. It's a repo.
Where else would you put them?
Where else would you put them? So you've got typically in the Ansible world, you'd have their cloud-based automation hub. That shows off all the official Ansible collections in a repo. And here comes the announcement. The announcement was the automation hub thing's been around for a while, but the announcement is,
What if, Ned, what if you want a private automation hub of your very own?
Ooh. And you know I do.
I know you do, baby. Well, now yeah. you can. Now you can. Private Automation Hub delivers a central location for internal automation communities to manage and curate their Ansible content privately using trusted content from Red Hat, its partners, and internal developers. In other words, if you don't want to do the public repo, build your own repo. You can put your own stuff in it. You can use official content in it, but it's your own repo mm-hmm. of Ansible collections. Collections, again, being that package distribution format to enhance your Ansible installation, depending on the kind of devices that you're trying to manage.
Okay, that makes sense. And I'm sure that this private automation hub is part of their paid offering, as opposed to the cloud one, which is probably part of their free offering.
As with all of the press releases, that was not clear, but that is also what I assumed, that that would be something you're paying for along the way to get your private automation hub. So, all right, Ned, that was Ansible Fest in a nutshell, me not attending and digging in as much as I wanted to. Again, just looking at the content that's there, though, I really genuinely recommend that if you're an Ansible person, you dig in to the content library. There is a lot of stuff there that I think would interest a lot of folks. And you're going to have the opportunity to learn a lot of things. If you're higher level or if you're up to your hips, I don't know, elbows, neck, up to your neck.
Sure.
Yeah,
neck sure.
Deep. Neck deep in Ansible. There's stuff in there that you probably care about. So it's worth the registration and getting access to the content library. Well, that's Ansible right. Fest 2020, Ned, in a day two cloud nutshell. HashiConf was HashiConf. The other one we wanted to talk about today, and it's all you, buddy. So I'm going to stop talking, and you go for like 30 minutes straight, no breath.
Okay? All right, no problem. I got it. All right. Today's episode of Day 2 Cloud is sponsored by Datadog, a monitoring platform for cloud-scale infrastructure and applications. Datadog provides dashboarding, alerting, application performance monitoring, and log management in one tightly integrated platform so you can get end-to-end visibility quickly. And it integrates seamlessly with AWS so you can start monitoring EC2, RDS, ECS, and all your other AWS services in minutes. Visualize key metrics, set alerts to identify anomalies, and collaborate with your team to troubleshoot and fix issues fast. Try it yourself by starting a free 14-day trial and installing the agent. Plus, you'll get a free Datadog t-shirt. Visit datadog.com/day2cloud to get started. That's datadog.com/daytwocloud to get started. Okay, so HashiConf is obviously HashiCorp's conference, and they do two a year. Usually they do one that's EU focused and one that's America focused. So this one would have been the America focused one. So most of the sessions were in US friendly time zones, but you could always watch a repeat of the session later if you missed it. So it's not like they were leaving anybody out. They basically had two tracks. There was like the main track and then a breakout track. And so there was always at least two sessions going on live, except for during the keynotes. And you could just tune into one of those two sessions live, and they had two MCs that were doing the transition between sessions. So it felt pretty polished. They kind of did this for the previous HashiConf earlier this year, so they kind of worked out some of the bugs. Overall, I mean, if you're going to do a virtual conference, this was decent.
Yeah.
The one thing that I did like about it was during the live keynotes and the sessions, they also had a live Q&A box running on the side that was moderated by the MCs and some other HashiCorp people.
So like text Q&A in a panel, like with data scrolling by?
Yeah. Kind of thing? Yeah. So you could make comments, or just, you could also ask questions. If someone in the session said something that you had a question about, you could throw that in the Q&A, and somebody else on the HashiCorp team could chime in with the answer if they know it. So mm-hmm. you could get that immediate feedback, kind of like raising your hand and asking a question in a session, but you can't do that. So this was the next best thing. So if you were watching live, you got to participate in that. If not, well, you're not live. Yeah, it's what it is. Now, they had been teasing that there were two big new products that they were releasing, and they were calling them Redacted 1 and Redacted 2.
Oh, good. I've been wanting to hear this because I got those emails. I'm on the HashiConf mailing list, and it's like, oh, big news coming. Hang on. So, okay. Yep. So were they all that big?
I mean, they were certainly new products from HashiCorp, so that is absolutely true. And I think both of them have the potential to become very big parts of their portfolio if they function as expected. I will preface this by saying both of them are version 0.1. So this is the bare minimum MVP that they felt comfortable showing out the door.
Okay. So before you tell us that the two new products here, maybe take a second and review for us the main products that HashiCorp is known for, because then we can understand how these new ones fit into things.
Absolutely. Okay. So they have probably about six products that they're really well known for. A lot of people discovered them with Vagrant, which was a way to run virtual machines locally, but they were packaged in a very Docker-esque way before Docker. So a lot of developers loved Vagrant because they could just load up a pre-configured VM, run their code on it, and feel pretty comfortable that it was going to run that way on an actual server because it was the same basic bits. And then you could create those images and other images using another tool called Packer. And Packer was basically take an operating system, customize it, and shoot out an image format on the other side, wherever I want this thing to deploy, whether it's in AWS or on VMware, whatever. So those were two big products they were well known for. And then they came out with Terraform, which we've talked about extensively. Yes, I don't think I need to review that. Vault, which is their secrets lifecycle management software. Console, which started out as a service discovery and DNS provider, but it also has a key value store. And now they're getting into some more advanced networking features with that.
Is there a Cates hook in for console? Because it feels like a lot of what the core functionality within Cates is service discovery, DNS, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. You can use console to do a lot of that within Kubernetes. So it can replace some of the components. And there's also a console agent, like a sidecar proxy that can run next to a regular container and provide the same proxying logic that you might have in something like Envoy. So it has all of that functionality. And then the last one is called Nomad. And Nomad is their orchestration and scheduler for application deployment. And it can do containers, it can do virtual machines, and it can do bare metal. So it's a pretty flexible, lightweight platform for doing all that. So that's their full product suite up until HashiConf, basically.
Okay, so that's interesting what you said about Nomad, because that feels Kubernetes-like as well.
Ooh, it does.
So between Nomad and Console, you've got an awful lot of Kubernetes kind of functionality in there. Okay, so lay it on us then. What are the new announcements? Okay.
So I'll talk about the two new products, and then we're going to circle back to Nomad, because there was some stuff about Nomad that came out as well. So we'll cover all of it. The first big product announcement is a product called Boundary. And Boundary is a bit like a Bastion host. If you're familiar with using a Bastion host to get into a private network, the whole idea was you have dynamic infrastructure that you might need access to. And the traditional way would be through VPNs, but VPNs don't lend themselves real well to resources being created and disposed of, and you have to have a lot of static credentials in different places. What if there was a better way? What Boundary does is it has some controllers that have the config and then worker nodes. And the worker nodes basically provide proxied connectivity from the outside into resources on the inside of your network. And that's all bartered through the controller plane of things.
Sounds like a complicated Bastion host. It's not as simple as jumping on the host and then jumping to where you need to go. It sounds more elegant and capable.
Those are good words, and I like them. Let's use those. So the idea is you would have different authentication mechanisms for authenticating to the controller, and then you would be a member in some roles and groups. Those groups would have access to certain sets of hosts, and it would be able to dynamically proxy the connection through to the host that you want to log into. And it could do it in such a way that the hosts on the back end can be automatically discovered and added to the correct sets for access. So if you have an autoscale group or some other type of infrastructure that gets created dynamically in the cloud, you can still access that stuff. And eventually the idea is that the credentials you're actually using to talk to that host are generated on the fly.
To talk to the Boundary host or to talk to the backend host?
to talk to the, well, both. So I would log into the Boundary host and say, I want to talk to this backend service. And then it would direct me to a worker node for that would actually do the proxying. Mm-hmm. The worker node, before it connected me to that resource, would go out to some sort of secrets lifecycle management or something, generate a temporary set of credentials for access to that resource, and then proxy that connection for me. And those credentials would be time bound. So even if someone intercepted it and got those credentials in an hour, they'd be invalid.
Yep.
So it's overkill for a small environment where you're only managing a handful.
It's a lot of moving pieces there, but that is cool.
It's a lot of moving pieces. But if you are working in a large dynamic environment where resources are getting created and destroyed, here's a way you could provide access to your ops folks to actually get in and try stuff out.
You were using words like worker nodes and so on, which all sounded very Kubernetes-like.
Doesn't it?
Is this their use case?
The use cases they were showing initially were mostly against virtual machines.
Okay.
So you have a fleet of virtual machines that you want to talk to, and the controller portion is virtual machines that act as the controller, and they can be clustered together. And the worker nodes are also probably going to be virtual machines. So this is not container specific. However, the backend that you're trying to talk to could be containers that you're connecting into. It doesn't have to be. So it could be bare metal. Out of the box, they're really just supporting TCP over any port. The idea is to eventually support SSH directly and some other remote protocols directly and being able to do that dynamic credential creation and all that kind of stuff. So it's a very interesting product. Like I said, it's also version 0.1. Mm. a lot of the stuff is more, this is where we want to get to. Please kick the tires on this new open source project and let us know what you think.
It feels like to make it work, it's got to understand things like service discovery and so on to understand when things are changing on the back end, where they are, what they are, how you get to them. There's a whole lot of things that the proxy is now doing for you where before you'd have to know. You know, at a traditional Bastion host, it's really dumb. You connect into it. Okay, you got in the door. Now you got to know how to go through the other door that I'm allowing you to connect to. And as long as you know where you're going, off you go. And you could get fancy and build some scripts or whatever, but it was all about networking is really what a Bastion host was with some security layered on. This is a whole different thing, man. Whole different thing.
It is. And fortunately, they have products like Vault, which can handle the dynamic yes. creation of credentials. And they have things like Consul, which can do service discovery. So obviously the idea is to tie those products into this product and create a cohesive offering out of it all. And the other thing I'll say is like setting all this up is somewhat complicated. I have set up the demo version of it. They have just like a dev server you can spin up, which is super easy. And then I tried to set up the reference architecture, and that is definitely more complicated. I imagine that they will eventually move this to a managed offering that you can deploy.
Will Boundary be open source in some flavor with commercial like many of their other products?
It's currently open source.
Yep.
I imagine they're going to layer a paid version on eventually, but not until there's a lot more functionality within the product.
Yeah, if there's a lot of complexity to it, especially for shops that really want it to run and run stably, it makes sense that that HashiCorp would make some money on this.
Yeah. All right. So that was big product announcement number one. That was day one. Day two, the big product announcement was a product called Waypoint. And this one, I struggled to understand a little bit more because it's very developer-focused. It's not an infrastructure tool. And like Boundary was very much ops, security, infrastructure.
Yeah.
Got it. I know what you want to do. Waypoint is, hey, you're a developer. I'm not. And you want a tool to help with all your other tools, I guess. So Waypoint is what they came up with. And the idea is pretty interesting. So you would have a Waypoint server, and you would create waypoint configurations. And those waypoint configurations would walk through what they consider the three steps of software development: build, deploy, and release. So the build stage would be when you actually take the code and compile it into executables or artifacts. That's something we're pretty used to.
That's straightforward.
We've helped developers set up a pipeline, whether or not we're building our own code. The second portion is getting those artifacts deployed somewhere and running. Not ready to be presented to the end user yet, but deployed and running. And that would be like pushing container images and getting it running on Kate or something.
Okay.
And then the release step is actually flipping the switch in some way to make those updated bits available to the end user, whether that's doing a blue-green deployment, slowly shifting traffic over in like a canary thing, or just doing a hard cut from version 1 to version 2.
Yeah, so Waypoint then is...
Waypoint is a service that you run a server that will accept updated configurations and reach out to various tool sets to accomplish these tasks. So you could run one instance of Waypoint server locally to do your dev stuff. And then when it's ready to move to the next phase in the staging, you would push that same configuration up to staging. You change your context. I think they call it a context. And have the staging server run through the same steps.
So it's kind of like a workflow management?
I think that's...
An orchestration tool for how you're actually deploying something within your organization, bringing it from, you know, from build to deploy to then release?
Yes. So essentially, it's a workflow management piece of software, and it's very extensible. It comes with a plugin system. So you can bring, say, Docker would be your image building system, and it has a Docker plugin. Your Kates could be your deployment, or Nomad could be your deployment process, and it has a plugin for Kubernetes and a plugin for Nomad. And then the release, same sort of thing. So it's a plugin-based architecture, just like, say, Terraform is, where you have all these different providers or plugins, and all of the configurations are written in HashiCorp configuration language version 2. So you define, here's my build stage, here's all the things that should happen in the build stage, here's my deploy stage, here's everything that should happen in that, and then here's my release stage. And it's all written in HCL, so it's pretty human readable. It's not YAML, which some people who are tired of YAML would probably appreciate. And it's relatively straightforward, at least the demos they showed were. Again, it's a version 0.1.
Is it anything like Azure DevOps?
It's a lot like other products that exist out there. My mind immediately went to Azure DevOps and Jenkins,
okay,
which have plugins that you can use,
yes,
and you can orchestrate a workflow through a pipeline. You can do all of that, but I think their idea was to actually zoom out a little bit further. And instead of focusing on build or focusing on deploy, it focuses on the entire workflow of getting software out and released and using some of the existing tool sets out there to do those individual stages, but having something that can live a little higher up in the stack to orchestrate that whole workflow. I have to admit, I was not entirely convinced. I was like, I feel like we've got a lot of products in this space. Like,
but maybe it's a HashiCorp family thing. You know, they see where they can put their product out and put their stamp on it, and people that are really big HashiCorp consumers and like their product family and like the way they do things might go, yeah, I think Waypoint's for me. I'm gonna invest in that. But like you say, when there are so many other products out there, particularly when companies have time invested and training invested and people know how to use it, it's got to be compelling to make the switch, right? Make the change.
Yeah, I think one of the things you brought up about Azure DevOps was very telling, the fact that Azure DevOps is very, you know, Microsoft focused. So yeah, you feel like you're in the Azure ecosystem. This is a more of a multi-cloud approach, more like a Jenkins, where it's not specifically aimed at a particular cloud or deployment type. So it has that more loose feel. And that's kind of all of HashiCorp's products have that feel, that we're not tied down to a specific cloud. Mm. We work on-prem and in any of the public clouds. That's the whole point. And for someone who's interested in learning tools that are not cloud specific, it's not a bad family to get acquainted with.
So those two big announcements then, Boundary and Waypoint. But you mentioned there was other stuff. For instance, Nomad had some news you wanted to share.
Yeah, this actually came out last week after HashiConf was over, but it was the release of Nomad 1.0 beta. And this is a big deal for HashiCorp because they don't take the 1.0 moniker lightly. Some other organizations might, you know, release a 1.0 of their product, and for them, that's like the MVP. for HashiCorp, if it hits 1.0, it has to be stable and no more breaking changes. So this is a big deal to them. And so the beta is out. And what was interesting to me is during the conversation about what's included in the beta and why they're moving to version 1, they made the obvious comparison between Nomad and Kubernetes as two different schedulers for scheduling applications to run. And they basically made the point that if you're looking for something with a vast ecosystem of things that connect into it, then Kubernetes is the thing that you probably want. It's incredibly flexible. It's got a huge ecosystem, but it's also kind of a beast to manage. Mm-hmm. Nomad, on the other hand, is smaller, more lightweight, and much more opinionated. So if Nomad fits the way that you want to deploy things, Nomad's a good fit.
Opinionated as in less flexible.
Yes. It has a smaller ecosystem. It has a way it wants you to do things. And if that doesn't fit with the way your organization is structured, then maybe Kubernetes is right for you. But they did make the point that you can have more than one product in this application scheduling space. And in fact, some of the bigger companies they work with are running Kubernetes for some things and Nomad for other things, yes, depending on what fit the best for the team that manages that application and the application itself. That's pretty much everything for HashiConf. It was like you mentioned, I watched the keynotes live, and that was pretty much it. I did deliver one of the lightning talks while I was there, and that was kind of interesting. It was a 15-minute talk that I had to give on a topic, and you think 15 minutes might be a long time, but it is not.
It is not. No, sir. That goes by very fast. In a flash, I would say.
It did. And I really had to rush through it. And I got everything in, and it's now available online. And I should say that everything, all the sessions, including the lightning talks, are all now available online. And the good news, for me at least, is you can watch any of them at 1.5 speed, 2 speed, whatever makes sense for you. So sometimes keynotes are a little fluffed up with stuff you don't care about. Watch it at 2 speed. It'll be fine.
What was your lightning talk topic, Ned?
Well, I went through the process of deploying HashiCorp Vault on Azure container instances as a way to test it out with a public endpoint as opposed to running it locally in a dev sort of scenario and keeping it really low cost, because when you kill the container instance, you're no longer paying for the compute and the config is stored in Azure storage, which is super cheap.
Meaning you can spin the container up again, you've got access to whatever you had in the vault before, and and off you go, meaning you're just spinning it up on the fly. So a cheap way to access it publicly rather than...
Yeah, so if you're trying to test out something that requires a public endpoint, that's a very low-cost way of doing it.
Okay, so I'm listening to this topic and going, how did you dare try to fit that into 15 minutes? You're nuts, man. That's just... I mean, I'm not familiar with either of those, you know, with this that topic at all, and it sounds like... Yeah, that's good. It's got to be, what, 45 minutes, an hour anyway?
I mean, it should have been. I've got the... So if anybody is interested in this, we'll include a link to the actual lightning talk. And I have all of of course, I stood up with Terraform, because what else would I use? So I have the Terraform config files and the scripts available on a GitHub repo as well. So you can play around with it if you want. So that was my lightning talk, and you're right. I overshot, way overshot, and I don't know if I made any sense in that 15 minutes, but it was fun. It was a good time.
Well, Ned, as we're wrapping up 2020 before too awful long, maybe 2021 we'll get back to live events and be able to do that safely. We'll see what the world brings us by way of pandemic vaccines and whether we're all going to even want to travel anymore now that we're used to working from home 24/7 and, you know, all that. I don't know, man. It'd be nice to be able to see people in person and do some of this stuff in meet space. That would be great.
It'd be nice to meet up with some Day 2 Cloud listeners out there too. Hey, everybody, we'd love to meet up with you face to face and chat about cloudy things. That would be that'd be kind of awesome. But I'm suspecting I did a podcast with Bobby Allen earlier today, and we were talking about this, and he feels like 2022 is when the first real conferences are going to fire back up in person. And I think he's probably right.
Yeah,
so we're going to have to deal with this virtual conference for a little bit longer.
Maybe we'll reinvent them and keep getting better, Ned. Yeah.
If you will. And hey, speaking of virtual things, virtual high five to you, listener, for tuning in and listening to Ethan and I ramble about virtual conferences, Ansible Fest, and HashiConf. If you have suggestions for future shows, you know, we would love to hear them. You can hit either of us up. I'm at Ned1313 and Ethan's at EC Banks on Twitter. And you could fill out the form on my fancy website if you'd like to do that. I actually got a submission last week. So how about that? Packet Pushers has a weekly newsletter. I don't know if you're aware of that. It's called Human Infrastructure Magazine, and it is loaded with the best stuff that we found on the internet, plus our own feature articles and commentary. It's free, and it does not suck. So, and you can get the next issue via packetpushers.net/newsletter. Thank you so much for listening, and until next time, remember, cloud is what happens while IT is making other plans.